Thank you, Denny, and thank you for omitting the Taylor Swift comparisons this time. I appreciate that very much. And Sam, I appreciate you reading 1 Corinthians 10, verses 1 through 11, at my behest. That was pretty well done and sets the stage for what I want to say. Continuing on with the theme from the morning class, whether you are here or not, this should stand on its own. But we were talking about the general concept of worldliness. And in that passage that Sam read, there is an important point. First thing to point out is that in 1 Corinthians, really, starting in chapter 7, Paul says, now I'm going to talk about the things you wrote to me. I wish we had a list of the things Paul had been written to about. I mean, I'd like to see what they actually said, what their precise questions were, but we don't have that. But we can kind of tell what the questions were from the things that he wrote. And in chapters 8 through 10, he's talking about the issue of meat offered to idols, which was a profound cultural issue for Christians at that time and place. So he's in the process in chapter 10 of discussing that, and he recounts in a part of Israel's experiences at the time of the Exodus and in the wilderness when God had brought all the Israelites out of Egypt. And yet he was displeased with some of them, even though he brought them out. And of the general assembly, he allowed all but Joshua and Caleb to die in the desert before they got into the promised land. Now, the passage that I asked Sam to read has nothing to do, per se, about sitting down to a meal in a Corinthian idol temple, which in that day was just considered a simple social convention. But Paul uses this passage to warn his readers that they may bring God's displeasure on themselves if they allow their bodily appetites to draw them into participation in demonic-type ceremonies. The point here is that the Exodus and the wilderness accounts in the Old Testament really say more than they say literally. Paul warns the Corinthian brethren to fully grasp the meaning of what they read in the Old Testament and apply it to the cultural issue at hand. Paul finds, and he finds by inspiration, that the Bible does provide guidance for the Corinthians' question once the Corinthian does enough with his Bible. In chapter 7, verse 1, he takes up these questions, now concerning the things whereof you wrote unto me. And this passage about meat offered to idols is in chapters 8 through 10. It's Paul's answer to the question they ask on that subject. And it's so relevant to so many of our discussions about cultural issues today that I think we should explore it a bit. It's a little bit complex, a little bit multifaceted in its discussion, but it helps us handle contemporary parallels. There were three things that could happen about meat offered to idols as far as the Corinthian Christians interface with them. There were various things that could happen. Number one, you could go over and have a meal in an actual idol temple facility. He talks about that in chapter 8, verse 10. But also, meat that you bought at the marketplace, and he covers this in chapter 10, verse 25, might be left over from an idol sacrifice, because when you prepare food, as you all know, you don't know exactly how much will be needed, and you don't want to run out, so you usually fix a little more than you end up needing. So what do you do with the leftovers? Those got sold in the shambles, which is what the marketplace areas were called. So it might be you just went down to buy your groceries, and in buying some meat, you got a hold of some meat that had been left over from an idol sacrifice. The third thing that could happen was you might be invited to a meal in a private home where meat offered to idols was being served. And he covers that in chapter 10, verse 27. But on this issue, it's always interested me that the Jerusalem Council, clear back in Acts chapter 15, had already ruled on the subject of meat offered to idols and prohibited it. Don't eat meat offered to idols. Acts 15, verse 29. And I've always wondered, why didn't Paul just settle this issue by quoting that ruling? All he would have had would say was three words, "We're not allowed," and let it go at that. But Paul is doing more than that, because he is showing people how to exercise spiritual discernment. And it's also possible that the Corinthians' question on the subject directly challenged the prohibitions of the Jerusalem Council, and that what Paul is doing here is defending it. I would just love to see the list of questions. I wish we had them, but we don't. Apparently we don't need them, or we would have them. But I always would like to see the full context of things if I can. But I'm just generating the possibility, based on Paul's answer here, that the challenge, if there was a challenge by the Corinthians, it might have run something like this. Now, Paul, don't you know that idols are nothing? They don't even exist. Therefore, meat cannot be defiled by idols. And therefore, how are we supposed to know where the meats that we buy at the marketplace come from, and what difference does it make anyway? We can ask, but what if the butcher doesn't even know where the meat he's selling came from? And what about when we go eat at a friend's house who doesn't care where his meat came from? How are we supposed to know whether it was an idol sacrifice or not? So this thing about not eating meat offered to idols ever is an unreasonable prohibition. I think a challenge like that would account for the details of Paul's discussion. These things could have been raised as a matter of sincere inquiry on the part of the Corinthians rather than as a challenge. But when Paul answers it, he has an open warning there about being too puffed up based on your knowledge. And it sounds like he thinks maybe there was some pride in the approach the Corinthians were taking. However that may be, Paul does call for abstaining from eating meat that's known to be idol meat. And this is consistent with the clear condemnation of the practice, as we have it later on in the words of Jesus himself in the letter to Pergamos, and the people that were associating with the Balaam doctrine. They were the Balaam doctrine. Part of that was partaking in meats offered to idols, which was prohibited there by the Lord, and also in the letter to Thyatira right after it in Revelation chapter 2. Those that were associated with the woman known as Jezebel, again, were practicing eating meats offered to idols. And the Lord condemns both of those. But Paul does not insist that nobody ever eat a bite of idol meat. And he gives the nuances about this. He says you don't have to ensure that it did not come from an idol sacrifice, because you're right, an idol is absolutely nothing. Chapter 8, verse 4. And there is only one God, therefore all other gods are excluded from existence. And an idol cannot defile meat that's offered to it, since it doesn't even exist. This is in chapter 10, verse 19. In other words, the meat itself is morally neutral. Jesus himself said that food cannot defile a person. You eat food, it just passes through your digestive tract, and in your digestive tract there are no moral operations taking place for the food to affect. So the idol and the food have no inherent reality that would cause defilement, but there's another reality that must be factored in. Some people consider the idol or the meat to be impure. And when such a person follows the lead of one who has knowledge, then they end up condemned by conscience, and thus they suffer spiritual harm. So even though there's nothing inherently wrong with the idol meat, abstinence is what best promotes the spiritual health of everybody. In chapter 9 of this same letter, Paul deals with a related matter of his freedom and his apostolic authority when he says, "Am I not an apostle? Am I not free?" Yes, he was an apostle. Yes, he was free. And therefore, he may deny himself for the good of those that God has called him to serve. Paul also expresses concern even for his own spiritual standing. That's why he said, "I keep under my body and bring it into subjection, lest after I have preached to others, I myself might be a castaway." So I don't want to think of myself more highly than I ought to think, and I don't want to think I'm standing when indeed I may be about to fall. Remember, in the case of Israel, what prompted part of the problem was there was an inordinate appetite for food. They were dissatisfied with the food that God had given them. God is going to provide for them everything they need. God provides for them the best and most nutritious food that they could possibly desire. And they were not satisfied with it. They remembered the stuff they had back in Egypt. They were so anxious to get out of Egypt. But once they're out, then they're remembering with fondness the food that they had back there. And they were also, by the way, guilty of idolatry, verse 7, fornication, verse 8, tempting God, verse 9, and grumbling, verse 10. So all these Old Testament passages that Paul is drawing on, hit points that are involved in the Corinthians' present situation when Paul is writing to them. The desire for certain foods, and by the way, the meat offered in the idol temples was almost always a very high quality meat. And also involvement in idolatry and fornication, which was openly practiced as part of the pagan ritual, and tempting God. Numbers 21, verse 5 and following, they were rejecting manna and wishing for other food, which amounted to tempting God. God had given everything they needed. The Israelites weren't satisfied with it. And today, Jesus is the living manna, John chapter 6. Paul is implying that the Corinthians' diet of Christ will preclude some of the meat eating that they have been enjoying. And hence the warning there about tempting Christ. Also, grumbling would be a natural response to those who didn't like Paul's ruling on the issue about meat offered to idols. So we can see what Paul is doing here. Without saying anything about the Corinthians' issue of idol meats in the passage Sam read, he's saying the Old Testament really says a great deal about this issue between the lines. Paul has done enough with the scriptures that he has found God's direction for this contemporary first century cultural question of meat offered to idols. Beginning in chapter 10, verse 14, he makes the case that meats offered to idols do include a spiritual dimension. And he makes this statement in verse 15. I speak as unto wise men. Judge you what I say. Very similar to some of the statements we found during the class time when Paul's talking to Timothy. Judge and discern rightly what I'm saying to you. Read between the lines. Look at the such things and so forth. He appeals to the Corinthians' wisdom, that is, their ability to grasp the reality of their present situation. To participate in religious ceremony is to fellowship with the deity that's being worshipped. He reiterates that idols are nothing. In fact, there's nothing, and the meat is nothing either. But behind the idol are demons. The demons are the ones who put the idea of the idols into men's minds in the first place for men to create the idol out of brick or stone or wood. And pagan ceremony, now it's the ceremony, not the meat, but pagan ceremony entails fellowship with those demons. This is why, he says, all things are lawful, but not everything is beneficial. Not everything edifies. That which is harmful or destructive has no place in your life, he says, regardless of whatever legal principles might be argued one way or the other. Now, where there's no ceremony involved, there's no need for concern over the origin of the meat. You don't even need to ask about it, he says. You can buy meat without even questioning its origin, because the meat can't defile you. In somebody's home, just don't ask any questions and go ahead and enjoy your steak. But if somebody calls attention to the fact that that meat was offered to an idol, then abstain. And in this way, you protect the conscience of somebody who has an issue with it. Somebody cared enough to bring it up to you, and therefore their conscience may be more tender than yours is. Or also for the sake of the unbeliever who's aware of the prevailing abstinence among the Christians and may think that you, as a Christian, will appreciate this information so that you can abstain. So don't tell him, oh, it's okay for me to eat it anyway, because it just became not okay for you to eat it because of what he told you. Paul is explaining the spiritual realities of the whole situation. His evaluation of this case exemplifies the value of a fully developed knowledge coupled with a fully developed love. Remember, love builds up. He says knowledge puffs up, but love builds up. And this knowledge includes scriptural knowledge, but it also includes knowledge of the culture. Most of us are only really familiar with one culture, and that is the only culture we really interface with, and that's the only culture we need to really only have knowledge of, because that's the culture we deal with. You don't have to have knowledge of every culture around the world in order to do what Paul's saying in this passage. We must allow the Bible to say all that it says on these matters, not only in the lines, but between the lines, guarding against the danger of imagining that it says more than it says, and we've all seen that done too. But we must make good judgments considering the effects that various courses of conduct on our part are likely to produce. Love for God and love for our neighbor denies personal pleasures sometimes in pursuit of the glory of God. What Paul's saying is that we rank our neighbor's welfare as equal to or even as above our own, and we rank God's interest above all. Me first is a fleshly mentality that always blinds us. But Solomon says to guard your heart. Proverbs 4:23. Guard your heart. Our growth in the knowledge of God will be stunted if we're unwilling to control our hearts and deny ourselves some of the things that our flesh loves and require of ourselves what our flesh resists. Instinct is often fleshly as it is spiritual. In fact, it's probably more often fleshly than it is spiritual. So Paul says, put things to the spiritual test and see how they fare. Approve all things, hold fast that which is good, 1 Thessalonians 5:21. Approve the things that are excellent, Philippians 1, verse 10. Present your body to God as a living sacrifice. Those who approach lifestyle questions with an intent just to justify what they want are sure to fall into error. So it's truth and edification that we want, and they can only grow from an abounding love for God and our fellow man. Now, having said that much, and by the way, I don't think I mentioned to you, Dan, that we do go till noon here. I think everybody else knows it maybe, but I didn't want Dan to think I was going overtime by a half an hour. Don't think I'm going overtime until it's afternoon. Number one, some principles here, just as time allows. Several things to keep in mind in thinking about worldliness. The first thing is that you and I, as Christians, do not need to reject everything that people of the world do. A non-Christian woman eats a bowl of cereal, kisses her husband goodbye for the day. God doesn't expect us to avoid that just because lost people do it. The points of the world's behavior that we must not mimic are those that show its vanity, its ignorance, its darkness, and its alienation from God, as depicted in the last half of the fourth chapter of the Ephesian letter, verses 17 through and 18 in particular. Give up living like pagans with their good-for-nothing notions. They are strangers to the life that is in God. But that doesn't mean that we don't do anything that pagan people do. We have to evaluate a particular point of culture by asking why people do it. Does the woman eat cereal and kiss her husband because she does not know God? No, of course not. Therefore, that's not a behavior that we need to reject. And I'm stressing that point because there are isolationist sects that go astray on this point. Just because culture does it, it must be wrong, no matter what it is. And that's not the point. That misses the New Testament point. A second principle. Detecting the world requires discernment, and not just a list of taboos. We have to use the brains that God gave us. You can't define the world so much as the world defines the world, and the world is constantly changing. That's the issue. Satan keeps an ever-changing kaleidoscope of attractions in front of us, so that just when you think you have a pretty good handle on a particular thing, that thing morphs into something different, and once again is challenging for us to assess. But there are constants of human nature at the heart of the world. John delineated him in what we quoted at the beginning of the class this morning, first thing. The lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life. These are detectable with scripturally conditioned discernment, combined with a self-denying honesty. Not much discernment is needed to detect the worldliness in some things. But detecting the full scope of worldliness takes a lot of discernment. And the problem here is that cultures are constantly changing. No culture that's living ever stays the same. Therefore, some of the boundaries of worldliness are constantly changing as well. There may be a neutral aspect of culture, but it may take on a moral significance for a while, and then it may go back to neutrality again. And many of us, like me, we've lived a long enough time to see this happen. Something may seem to have significance for a while. People who see it may apply a meaning to it in their minds, and then later on it's a dead issue. A particular style of clothing, or a particular wearing a beard, for just as an example. It may seem to take on a moral significance for a while and then go back to neutrality again. It's a dead issue now, I think. It's a mistake to impose the sensibilities of one culture on another culture, past, present, or future. And except where the Bible is clear on universal human issues, only those familiar with a culture are able to accurately evaluate the boundaries of worldliness within that culture. The only culture in which God requires us to keep ourselves unspotted from the world is the one, or in some cases, the few cultures that we actually live in. There are people that go around the world a lot, and they're in various cultures from one day to another in some cases. They just need to be aware of how living the Christian life is done in those various cultures. Another principle, our distinctness from the world should focus on things that affect our ability to know God and to make Him known to other people. At the heart of this world lies ignorance of God. The world suppresses the knowledge of God. So we need to be alert to cultural influences that hinder our ability to know God as He really is. We need to be alert to cultural influences that can be used to bring knowledge of God into people's minds. Paul did that on Mars Hill. He quotes from pagan philosophers and poets just to make the point that people would recognize these. He makes the point that how that fits in with seeking to find a relationship with God. Paul had to know some of the culture in order to do that. As a son of a Pharisee, he would not be naturally attuned to doing that, but he had applied himself to learn something about the culture so that he could relate to the people within it. The devil is content for us to think about God as much as we want to think about God, as long as we don't think correctly about God. And we find this very early in the Bible. In Satan's conversation with Eve, as punctuated in the King James Bible at least, there are two sentences uttered by Satan there, and God is prominent in both of those sentences. Satan likes to talk about God too. He knows he can't keep us from thinking about God, and so he uses every method possible to corrupt our concept of God's character. He makes God seem stricter than he is if he can. Telling lies about God is one way to make us think wrongly about God, and the other is concealing truths about God. Everybody needs to understand all that the Scriptures tell us about God. Satan is content for us to feel warm and fuzzy toward God as long as we don't have a life-changing relationship with God. Judas, for example, appeared to fit right in with the other apostles, even though he remained a greedy thief throughout his years in Jesus' public ministry. He didn't really fit in, but he appeared to superficially. And the other apostles must have felt that he fit in pretty well, even though he was from a different place, from a little different culture. But at the Last Supper, when Jesus says, one of you is going to betray me, they didn't point over at Judas and said, it's him, isn't it? No, they said, Lord, is it I? Is it I? So I don't think they knew what Judas was until later on, because he appeared to fit right in with the other disciples. When we're considering a questionable action, we need to ask, will what I am doing keep unsaved people from seeing God's true nature in my conduct? Does the Bible lead me to hope that my nonconformity to the world on this particular point might convict a lost person's conscience about his own sin? Asking a question hypothetically like, will my wearing bright colors prevent people from seeing God in me? You know, there are people who won't wear bright colors because of the way they believe their Christian faith dictates that they should live. Does the Bible lead me to believe that the colors in my wardrobe constitute a sin for which I must repent for my salvation? Does the Bible lead me to believe that the colors in my neighbor's wardrobe constitute a sin for which he must repent for salvation? Some say yes. Some say you should only drive black cars. I know people. They'll only drive a black car. And some of them live not too far from here, really. They have a particular persuasion from a German religious background that would prohibit them from driving anything but a black car because anything else is just too much. If you take those sentences that I was giving you about the colors and we substitute modesty in place of color in those questions, it works just as well. Immodest dress is a way that we can hinder fellow Christians. Good works are supposed to be what's noticeable about a woman professing godliness. It's an interesting shift that's taken place here, a cultural shift. A century ago, in our country, the ideal of that day for a woman was inner beauty. We've had a cultural shift away from good works to good looks, away from godliness to worldliness. 1 Peter 2 deals with this. 1 Timothy 2 deals with it. 1 Peter 3 deals with it. The virtue of staying sexually pure has been, in our culture now, replaced by the virtue of staying physically fit. Working out has become the new self-purification ritual, invested with a lot of positive moral meaning in the world we live in. Good girls work out. Bad girls let themselves go. But modesty now is viewed as a quaint sentiment of a bygone era. But it still is an issue in the mind of God. The New Testament says too much about it for us to not mention it occasionally. And an immodestly dressed woman in the assembly of the saints can ruin the spiritual impact that that meeting might otherwise carry. An immodestly dressed woman in the assembly can distract three quarters of the people there, all of the men and half of the women who are worried about the men. And there is not one square inch of our lives that God is not concerned with, and that includes our closets. Immodesty can provoke constant sin, robbing its victims of opportunities to deepen their knowledge of God. Immodesty demystifies and devalues, it breeds shallowness, and it tempts. Godly men need help, and they need women to provide it. Modesty makes it easier for friendship to be centered around God the way it ought to be, and for fellowship to be unhindered the way it ought to be. The kind of allure that lasts is protected and inspired by modesty. So conforming our appearance or lifestyle to that of a subculture that's known for its refusal to obey God could hinder our effectiveness in communicating God's message. We don't want to leave the impression that we don't think that God objects to a particular subculture's behavior if it is blatantly anti-God. But I'm not saying that a Christian that looks like any unbeliever is worldly. It's not that simple. There are generic modes of dress that don't communicate anything about morals. There are also things that are specific to subcultures that are known for evil and deviance. The Lord does not require any uniquely Christian form of dress. And I need to stress that because I know cultures where they believe that it does. But Peter, for example, was identifiable as a disciple of Christ by his accent, not by his clothing. To strangers, when they met him, they could tell where he was from by his accent. They weren't thinking about his clothing. We find that in Matthew 26, verse 73. Ephesians 5:11 seems to forbid us from adopting trends that are widely recognized as associated with self-indulgent or deviant behavior. But we don't need to dress in a way that just screams Christian, if that was even possible to do. We shouldn't dress in a way that leaves people who know both our culture and our Bible sensing an inconsistency between our belief and our conduct. We are responsible to make clothing choices that don't raise those kinds of questions. In any case where the effect of a thing on our ability to know God and to make Him known is clear, then the appropriateness of that thing is settled. And this gives us a scriptural basis for our lifestyle choices. Another principle. God does not intend a uniform level of cultural participation or isolation for all of us. Remember His prophets in the Old Testament as examples. They were extremely different from one another. Elijah was a rugged man of the outdoors. Daniel served amid the opulence of royalty for decades of his life. Amos was a cattleman. John the Baptist was countercultural in his clothing and in his diet and in his shelter. Jesus participated in the everyday affairs of His society, and Jesus rebuked His generation for scoffing at both John the Baptist and Himself. God calls to the world, always through His Word, of course, but also through all of us, and He does this in a variety of ways. To leave the world without excuse when they reject all of the things that God sends them. We should expect variety of lifestyle among the people of God. And we should be very careful about judging one another in these areas. It's all within the boundaries, of course, of biblical holiness and purity. Paul followed a pattern of cultural participation and flexibility. That's why he said, I have made all things unto all men, that I might by all means save some. He was a Jew, a Hebrew of the Hebrews, a Pharisee, the son of a Pharisee. He had that aspect. He could relate to any Jew on any level of Jewishness you wanted to relate. But he also had lived in places like Tarsus, and he could relate to Gentiles in a cultural way, so much so that he was the apostle sent to the Gentiles. This I do for the gospel's sake, he said. Paul doesn't want to place any unnecessary obstacles in any lost person's path to Christ. So as an apostle to the Gentiles, his lifestyle doesn't have Jewish elements in it that imply that Gentiles have to become Jews before they can become Christians. He doesn't want to put that stumbling block there. At the same time, a Jew longing for the salvation of his own nation, as Paul is, he avoids giving any impression of disrespect for the law of Moses. So we need some cultural flexibility to avoid unnecessary hindrance of the gospel. Believe me, the gospel contains enough offense just on its own. Just when you tell the truth, it's offensive enough. We don't want to make it more offensive than it needs to be. As we've seen, Paul would risk offending an unbelieving dinner host rather than damaging a fellow believer's conscience. He doesn't join pagans in their idol ceremonies, even though the idol doesn't exist. Those outside of Christ are sinners and will be damned if they don't change, and that message is offensive enough. We need to avoid adding further offense to it by attaching unnecessary cultural conditions or requirements to it. If you're working with naked natives in the jungle, you don't enhance the gospel by stripping naked yourself. The gospel is best supported by a lifestyle that's in contrast to the sinful ways of whoever and whatever the target audience is. If you're working in another part of the world, go ahead and adopt their diet, but not their sins. Diet within Bible boundaries, of course. When you're in Rome, don't do as the Romans do. Do as the Romans ought to. Jude says, others save with fear, pulling them out of the fire, hating even the garment spotted by the flesh. So in rescuing sinners, we don't embrace their impurity just to be able to relate to them. A fifth principle, and I'm well aware of the time here, but this is an important principle. Worldliness is a problem for all of us, not just for some of us. If you're not Jesus, and you aren't, then you have a propensity for worldliness, just like I do and all of us do. We should expect Scripture to confront us, and we should expect Scripture to correct us, and we ought to bow to its authority when we see that. We ought to find that the Bible not only affirms us and never corrects us, if we find that the Bible only affirms us and never corrects us, then we should find from that we are failing to do enough with the Bible. Because the Bible will always correct you on some point if you're reading your Bible right. One of the devil's ways of keeping us from helping each other discern and overcome our worldliness is to keep us arguing about it. And we've seen a great deal of that in past decades. Some of us are inclined to give the world too much place in our lives. Others are inclined to so much isolation from the world that we're unable to even reach it with the gospel. The boundaries of worldliness change within changing cultures. Some perceive those changes more quickly and more accurately than others, but all of us find our flesh attracted to some form of ungodliness. And none of us has an infallible understanding of all of the issues involved at any given point in time. That's why we need one another's help in understanding biblical teachings and practices and principles for our time. We must learn to discount the value of our own personal preference. How I feel is only a very small and secondary point. The question is, what does the Bible really teach? What morality is behind what is happening in our culture on this point or that in a given time? What will the spiritual effect of the various possible available alternatives that I could choose be? What if I do this? What if I do that? What if I say this? What if I do say that? We need to take these things into account. And I think in the class we've helped each other a little bit in determining some of those things. Probably very few of us can rise to Paul's ability to be all things to all men, that he might by all means save some. He was especially equipped by God for that. But collectively, all of us together, we can be used by God as individuals to reach people of every kind. Our differences serve to hold one another's tendencies toward error in check because we correct each other. The truths themselves are unchanging, but matters of worldliness do not all submit themselves to once-for-all resolution, since they involve human cultures with their continuous change. There are some people like Demas who forsake the Lord in favor of the world. Others fall into an asceticism that sees a complete denial of bodily appetites and pleasures as a religious virtues. Most of us, though, avoid both of those errors, and therefore we can expect to find among ourselves some differences of understanding and emphasis. Romans chapter 14 and 15, there don't seem to be a lot of expectations there that all the differences are going to be resolved, and Paul doesn't say we need to resolve all these things. He just says we need to speak the things of the Lord. When we're dealing with things he did not specifically legislate on, we need to be all having the same goal. We owe it to the Lord and ourselves and the lost world to try to resolve as many of the differences regarding worldliness as we can. Well, there's a lot of other things to say upon this, but we've exhausted our time, and so we will conclude once again extending the Lord's invitation. I'll just say that whatsoever things are true, honest, just, pure, lovely, and of good report, these are the things that we ought to be thinking about. And the word think is involved in both of our lessons today. By the way, the word think in that passage, think on these things, we get that from the mathematical word from which we get the expression logarithm. It's the same as the word think in that verse. It means a deliberate and prolonged contemplation, as if one were weighing a mathematical problem. So when he says, pure, honest, lovely, of good report, think on these things, he means give a deep consideration to them. We'll leave the lesson with you this morning. Never knowing the hearts of those present, we extend the Lord's invitation to any who are outside of Christ. If you'd come to Jesus in simple trusting faith, we invite you to do that and obey him in immersion in water for the remission of sins. If you are in Christ but have something to bring before the brethren here, if you have anything that needs to be dealt with in a public manner, we invite you to come to one of these front chairs so that we can deal with it as we stand together. And we're going to sing one more song. Danny?